This is London Calling.
Hi, I'm Graham Mack, and my guest this week is showbiz royalty. It's the radio presenter, Tony Prince, a man who's appeared on the same Las Vegas stage as Elvis Presley. We talked about his amazing life and his career, and that night when a prince met a king.
They welcomed me, not knowing who the hell I was, and I said, ladies and gentlemen, my name's Tony Prince, I'm a DJ from Radio Luxembourg in Europe. Well, half of them must have been in the army in Germany, because they all stood up and clapped, because Luxembourg was so important to them while they were in Europe, you know, not just to the Brits. So that was nice. And I said, who's come more than 2,000 miles to be here? Who's come more than 5,000? And so it went on. I said, these people with their hands up, there's just 200 people with their hands up now. I said, these are the Elvis Presley fan club of Great Britain. And they got a massive round of applause, you know. So they suddenly felt like stars. I said, you know what it's like? Elvis has never performed in Europe. And we have a saying, don't we? If Mohammed won't come to the mountain, those 200 hands in the air represent a British mountain of love and adoration for the king. And ladies and gentlemen, the biggest thrill of my life is to be here tonight and introduce Elvis Presley, and that was it. Then I was out.
Going back. You'd prepped nothing ahead of time.
I'd prepped nothing. I'd lived the whole damn thing. And I'm walking off stage now, and they've started playing Also Zarathustra, yeah, the theme tune, you know, 2001. And as I'm walking off stage, over in the right-hand side is Elvis, and he's looking at me, and he's clapping his hands gently at me, you know. Ah, wow. I mean, I can still tear up thinking about that, you know.
More from Tony Prince later, but first, let's have a look at what's been happening in Britain, and we'll start with some news about those other royals. The heir to the throne, Prince George, had his first day at school this week. It's an exclusive private school, because you want him to get a good education. Don't want him to end up in some dead-end job. And his mum, Kate, has announced that she's pregnant with a third child. But you're not happy about this, Ken.
Well, I just think what's going on in the world, all the trouble, and everybody's going on about another kid for the royals.
Last night, I looked at I have all the news and stuff on my phone, and I looked at the Sky News site, and it was talking about the impending nuclear war with North Korea.
Yep.
I went to the Daily Mail app, and the lead story was that she's having another baby.
He's got two kids. Why don't you go and have a vasectomy?
The entire population of the UK are victims of mis-selling. Mis-selling is the deliberate, reckless or negligent sale of products or services in circumstances where the contract is either misrepresented or the product or service is unsuitable for the customer's needs. For example, selling life insurance to someone who has no dependents is regarded as mis-selling. According to the Daily Telegraph newspaper, Britain's financial services industry has payment protection insurance claims for PPI sold with credit cards. Those claims are worth about £13 billion. But the biggest mis-selling scam in UK history is Brexit. Before the referendum to leave the EU, the Leave campaign had posters and a big red bus with the slogan that said, "We send the EU £150 million a week. Let's fund the NHS instead. Vote Leave." The NHS is the National Health Service, our socialised medicine. Well, the day after the referendum, on the 24th of June 2016, Nigel Farage, the leader of the pro-Leave UK Independence Party, admitted on live TV that it was a mistake to promote that £350 million a week could be spent on the National Health Service if the UK backed a Brexit vote. In March this year, the Prime Minister, Theresa May, admitted that after Brexit, £350 million a week will not go to the National Health Service. In fact, the opposite's true. In May this year, experts warned that the NHS faces an extra bill of £500 million a year due to Brexit. And the bill could be even higher if the NHS has to pay to replace staff if EU migration is reduced. The NHS relies on migrant workers. they'll also have to pay more for medicines. This is all according to the health think tank, the Nuffield Trust. Then there's the cost of getting out of the EU. We don't know what that'll be yet. But figures between 7 and 50 billion pounds have been talked about. And that's just the fee we'll have to pay the EU. There's considerable cost in rewriting thousands of EU rules, regulations and laws that will have to be converted into British statutes, and entire departments that will have to be set up to oversee and police things that were previously handled by Brussels. Then there's the value of our currency, the pound. Since the vote to leave, it's dropped by 15%. We haven't even left yet. Financial experts predict that soon the pound will be worth the same as the euro. It could be worth even less. That will eventually push up the rate of inflation, which has already started to climb. The British Retail Consortium says the cost of shopping is going to go up. Brexit has been missold. Aaron Banks, who bankrolled the Leave campaign, has admitted that mis-selling went on. He's quoted as saying, "We always knew that the referendum would come down to two things, the economy on the inside and immigration on the outside, so that if we could keep the subject on immigration, we'd win." Some people have done very well out of Brexit, though, particularly politicians. Theresa May became the Prime Minister because of Brexit, and Boris Johnson became Foreign Secretary. When the banks missold PPI and other investments, it resulted in compensation for the victims and heavy fines for the perpetrators. The mis-selling of Brexit resulted in the opposite: rewards for those who did it and penalties for the victims. Britain's bus drivers have been getting a hard time lately for being, well, too miserable. But Linda, you met one that was over-friendly.
I was on the bus, and because I'm quite a chatty person anyway, as I was going to get off the bus, I was handed this piece of paper. Huh. And I thought, what's this? Anyway, the bus driver obviously liked the way I was, and he actually said, if you'd like to come for a drink, here's my number.
The bus driver tried to pick you up.
Yeah, he actually gave me, on the way off the bus, he gave me a piece of paper with his name on, his number, to give me a call.
Did you give him a call?
No.
Finally, a politician has done the right thing by the environment. Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister of Scotland, has announced that she's committing her government to a deposit return scheme on bottles and cans. Up until now, politicians have not given us any incentives to go green. Instead, they fine us and refuse to legislate and blame us. They've taxed our air travel, our fuel, and driving in central London. Those things haven't worked because we're still flying and driving dirty diesels, and London's streets are still congested. An example of how the government blames us is the current system for recycling. Local councils pick up waste, but only from private homes. Commercial businesses have to pay to have bottles and cans taken away for recycling. Pubs and restaurants use more bottles and cans than any household, probably more than an entire street, but the government is in the blame game, so they only pick up the recycling from your house to make you feel like you're the problem. Well done, Scotland. Getting cash back for returning used bottles and cans is the obvious way to reduce the damage done to our environment by this waste. The only questions I have are, with this being such an obvious solution, why has it taken so long to get here? And why is it only in Scotland? Hey, wait a minute. If I hired a fleet of trucks, I could collect bottles and cans from pubs and restaurants in England, saving them the cost of having them taken away, drive them across the border to Scotland, and cash them in! spoke to Linda earlier, who was on a bus, and the bus driver gave her his phone number. Hooking up on a bus? Julia, you had someone try to hook up with you on the M25 motorway. How did that work?
Right, so it was a few years ago now. It was at the time of the fuel blockade, where the lorries were complaining about the fuel price hike.
Yeah.
And all these lorries were blockading the fuel depots.
Right.
So you couldn't get fuel.
Yeah.
And at the time, I was driving quite a thirsty vehicle.
Yeah.
Anyway, I sat in a queue, very grumpy, on the M25, which is quite standard. And it's about, I mean, I used to go really early, so this is about 6 in the morning. And
yeah.
There's a lorry next to me. And asked me why I did. So I like, wound, put the window down. And just like yelled and just said, well, can't you lot go off and, you know, do something? Why are you blocking the blockade? And
yeah.
I'm like, watch my fuel gauge down. Anyway, he started sort of to talk to me, and then he goes, ring the number on the cab, because he was a self-driver.
Yeah.
So we started chatting, and we chatted probably for about a month or so.
Yeah.
We were always travelling on, by car phones, sort of, you know, backwards and forwards. And then eventually we met, and we went out, and we have a son, and we did get married.
Wow! Wow, what a great meeting story. You met on the M25.
On the M25 in a queue with me having a go at him as a lorry driver, and he uttered those immortal words, ring the number on the cab.
Wow, so he had everything that it took to be a husband. He was used to having a woman whining at him.
Yes, oh, absolutely. Yeah, he was very good at that.
Breaker 19, this here's a rubber duck. You got a copy on me, love machine? Aw, 10-4 pig pen. For sure. By golly, it's clean, clear to Taco Town. Yeah, we definitely got us the front door, good buddy. Mercy sakes alive, looks like we got us a convoy.
Whose fault is it that you're fat? A report came out this week that says the UK's obesity crisis is being fuelled by businesses pushing unhealthy food and larger portions at shoppers. The Royal Society for Public Health says we're being tricked by a marketing ploy known as upselling. This is where shops and cafes and restaurants ask you if you'd like to upgrade to a larger portion or add a high-calorie topping or side. The most popular upsells are larger coffees, bigger meals, sweets and chocolates, and extra sides such as onion rings and chips. Research shows that the average person consumes an extra 17,000 calories a year because of upselling. Some people are calling for a ban on upselling. The thing is, we're not being tricked. No one's saying that it's healthier to consume more. And no one's being forced to go large. Retailers are doing nothing wrong. They're in the business of selling. And that's all they're doing. Human beings should be in the business of staying healthy. It's the customers that are at fault here, because they can't say no. It's not the business's problem. But then again, this is Britain, where nothing is your fault. You can blame any of your problems on anybody. The government, big business, migrants, the banks, the EU, the National Health Service, anything you want, except you. Banning upselling will not reduce calorie intake. It'll reduce guilt and personal responsibility. And a reduction in those two things will make you fatter. So we've been talking about times someone has tried to hook up with you in unusual or awkward circumstances. Mick,
you know, I went to this house to have a look at this job for this lady. Really nice lady, posh lady.
And what was the job?
It's looking at a settee. I'm an upholsterer, and I was looking at the settee for her.
Yeah.
And I walked into the house, beautiful house, and her mum was sitting in the corner. Her mum was in her 60s, well in her 60s. And she introduced me to her mum and everything, so I said, yeah, no problem at all. And then she goes, I've just got to go and do something. She left me in the room with her mum.
Right.
And her mum looked at me, and she goes, I would. And
what?
I said, sorry? She goes, I would. What are you doing later? And I sort of said, I just sort of laughed it off. And she goes, we could spend a couple of nights together if you want to. And
wait a minute. Around about, she's in her 60s. What age were you, Mick?
30s.
She's looking for a toy boy.
She's looking for a toy boy. Obviously, the daughter didn't know what she was doing. And then the daughter came back in again, and she goes, oh, you having a good chat with mum and everything? And I sort of said, yeah. And then as I was walking out, her mum slipped me a bit of paper with a number on it.
She was serious then?
She was serious, yeah.
Needless to say, you never called it.
No, I was married.
Oh, right. Oh, that's terrifying. That is really, really scary.
It was scary, yeah. She was all over me. She was. And she had lipstick on her teeth and everything. You know when they put so much lipstick on?
Jim's on Skype from Philadelphia, and Jim, we've been talking about North Korea lately.
And I think you're right. I was watching the news last night, and somebody said that North Korea just wants to be recognized as a nuclear power.
Yeah, he just wants to
That's
feel
what they're
special.
Looking for.
Yeah. So let's just go, okay, we get it. You're a nuclear power. Join
All
the
right.
club.
All right, fine.
Yeah, no, but remember, though,
and the
one of the first rules of nuclear power club is you don't do any nukes. You don't fire any of them off. That's the first rule. You're not allowed to shoot them at anybody. You're allowed to have them, not allowed to shoot them. If you shoot them, you'll be out of the club.
Yeah. And it sort of reminded me of it's two petulant children.
Mm-hmm.
And North Korea has just had their bar mitzvah, and they're a man now.
Yes.
Kim Jong-un is a 13-year-old boy who's just been bar mitzvahed and wants the world to know,
yes.
I'm a man now.
That's right, so don't mess with me.
And Donald Trump is a 13-year-old classmate and who's a Protestant and saying, you're not a man, you're 13, just like I am. No, I'm not, I'm a man now. Just ask my father. China? China's the key, I think.
Absolutely. No doubt about it.
And is China going to say, all right, shut up, enough?
Yes. You sit over there. You sit over there. Don't go near each other. But the thing is, they're talking about more sanctions. Well, who was it said, if you keep doing what you always do, you'll keep getting what you always get? How have the sanctions worked out so far?
It's Einstein's definition of insanity. Doing the same thing and expecting a different result each time.
Yeah. So what did sanctions do? Well, sanctions brought us to the brink of nuclear Armageddon. That's what sanctions did. What do you think more sanctions will do?
Yes. Yes. it's just stupidity.
But they need to set up a meeting.
It's two petulant children.
Yeah, but they need to talk to him. They're not talking to him. They've decided. Who was it said? His actions show that he's begging for war. Oh, so instead of meeting him and asking him, we've decided what he's begging for. We don't know. We're guessing. So now we're going to bring in policies based on a guess? Why not ask him what he wants? Sit down with
him. Okay, fine. Oh, you want to be recognized as a nuclear power? Fine. We recognize you.
Yeah.
All right. We're done.
Yeah.
Are you okay now? Can you shut up? Can you shut up from now on? Well, no, we recognize you. No. Yes. Oh, you've got them.
Yeah.
And they one news outlet interviewed an international relations teacher from Seoul,
mm-hmm.
who equated North Korea giving up their nuclear program,
mm-hmm.
would be equivalent to the Pope saying, ah, you know what? We're done backing this guy, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
They love their program. They love it. We're a world power.
Yeah.
It's for them to say, oh, no, you know what? We're done with it. We were just kidding.
But I mean, Britain.
For them to back down on it,
they're just, not going to back
not
down.
Not going to happen.
If you were to say to Britain, and Britain is a nuclear power, but a very small one, I think we've got, is it 3 or 6 nuclear submarines? It's not many. That's it. That's all we've got. We used to have American-based missiles at Greenham Common. We don't have that anymore. We've got these submarines, a handful, literally, of submarines. That's all we've got. We are a nuclear power, but only just. And why? Because if it all kicked off, it's going to be America, Russia, China. It's going to be the big guys. We're going to get caught in the crossfire. We're not going to be able to defend ourselves against Russia with a handful of submarines. It's not going to work.
Yeah.
It's not going to work.
Yeah.
So we're the same thing. We've got them for the same reason. We've got nuclear missiles because we want to be in the nuclear club and we want to feel special. We want everyone to go, ooh, Britain, ooh, they've got nukes. Ooh, yep, we got nukes. Yeah, we got our nukes. Yeah, we got the nukes. And if you said to us, you know, we think you should pack that in, you know, you should come out of the nuclear. We'd be like, how dare you? We're Britain. We're special. But, you know, Britain is very, very similar to North Korea. We have an unelected head of state who everybody fawns over. And if you say the wrong thing about them, well, you're not looked too kindly on. You might not be killed, but I think there is still the death penalty for treason. I'll give you an example. I worked in Bournemouth many years ago, first UK radio station I worked at, and I'd just come over from Australia and I'd forgotten how backward British radio is. And the Queen was doing a royal walkabout, and England were playing Germany in the World Cup in France, and that's the big grudge match, England versus Germany.
Yeah.
And it was on TV that night. She's doing a royal walkabout, and one of the TV reporters said, "Will you be watching the game tonight, ma'am?" And she went, "Ew, when's it on?" She had no idea what he was talking about or what game. No idea. So on the next morning on the radio, I said, "Did you see that?" I said, she clearly had no idea. Silly cow. Well, a complaint goes into, at the time they were called the Radio Authority, our version of the FCC. And they came back and upheld the complaint. They didn't fine me, but they could have done if they wanted to. They didn't fine me. But they basically said, "You should not have said that on the radio." Now, if I'd have called pretty much anybody else in the country a silly cow, nothing. But because it was the monarch, I'm in trouble. How North Korean do you want to be? And that is what, you know, you can't criticize the unelected head of state here. You can't do that there. We're very, very similar.
That's the equivalent of saying, oh, that guy's got a silly haircut.
If you said that in North Korea on the radio, it would be bad. You're not allowed to say that on the radio in North Korea. And but they don't see that here. That, you know, look at the way there's another royal baby on the way. Look at the way they fawned over the last two. The press were reporting things that the kid was doing, or any of the kids are doing at whatever age, 2, 3, 4. They were reporting them as if no child had ever picked up a building block before and smiled. They were.
Yes. And he's taking his first steps. I think George or Charlotte.
Yeah.
Oh, they're taking their first steps. This is today on Baby Watch.
Yeah. Literally, yesterday, I'm flicking the news channels on my phone. Sky News lead story about nuclear North Korea. Dailymail.co.uk lead story. Kate's having another baby. I'm sorry, that's not news. It's not news. And we are treating the royals like the North Koreans treat Kim Jong unhinged. And Kim Jong unhinged, if you read what the North Korean people are told about him, they're told he's like an Olympics standard athlete. He does not defecate. He is a superhuman being. We're told the same rubbish about the royals. She cut a ribbon in Scotland this week and opened a bridge. The way it was reported, you think she'd single-handedly built the bridge. She's just a nice old lady, for goodness sake. But yeah, the way that the North Korea thing is, it's like North Korea is like an extreme example of Britain. I mean, I can be told I shouldn't criticize the Queen on the radio when I do it. But in North Korea, I would have been shot. That's the only difference, is the penalties.
That's
the penalties are a bit harsher. But there's no real difference in the rules. They're the same. Exactly the same. And, you know, when Kim
Jong... You still get a talking to, only you're alive.
Yeah.
Whereas in North Korea, you'd be shot.
Yeah. And the way the news media reports the royals is the same way that the North Korean news media reports Kim Jong unhinged. I mean, when his dad died, Kim Jong Il, mentally ill, as David Letterman used to call him, when he died and they showed all these, say the whole nation was in mourning. Same deal here when Princess Diana died. Princess Diana was a tragic thing, but none of the news we got was true. I lived in Bournemouth, which is a very royalist, conservative stronghold. That evening, the Sunday evening, Julie and I went to the movies. All the restaurants on Westover Road in Bournemouth were full, as usual. The Pizza Hut was full. We watched Men in Black. The cinema was reasonably full. And then you get home and watch the news. The nation is in mourning, you know. The next morning on the radio, we were forced to play subdued music and panpipe music. But, you know, the following day I'd had enough and we went back to normal programming. We ran the birthday wheel where you could win money if your birthday came up the right date. We played the secret sound contest. We played Oasis and the Spice Girls and we didn't get a single complaint. You get home that night, you turn on the TV. The nation is in mourning. Britain is standing still. It's not. It's not. It's not. It's not. It's not. Yeah. Stop saying it is. It's not. It's tragic. People are sad about it. People are talking about it. It's a big deal. But people are not in mourning for someone they've never met and had no influence on their life whatsoever. They're just not. Stop showing these pictures of these same 16 women wailing at the palace gate. Most of them pensioners. I mean, stop it. And that's what we had. On the day of the funeral, which was the following Saturday, I went to a wedding. Nobody can't. This couple didn't cancel their wedding. There were no TV sets at the wedding, so nobody at the wedding saw the funeral or really was bothered about it. They know it'll all be on the news and repeated all week. There was a five-piece rock band played. Nobody said that was inappropriate. Life went on. People went to work. People continued to get married. Nothing changed in Britain. But you turn on the TV, Britain is at a standstill, a nation in mourning. For a week we had that. And that's exactly
that's something
how North Korea. Yeah,
when a celebrity dies.
Yeah.
And they cut to the somewhere outside, wherever it is.
Yeah.
And there's people just in mourning.
Yeah.
Well, did you know them? No. No, I had no idea who they were. I never met them.
Yeah.
Well, why are you wailing and crying your eyes out? I don't know. Did you meet them? No. Well, why are you crying?
Yeah.
Did they have an effect? They wrote a song that you enjoyed. Yes. Did you actually meet them? No. Well, I don't understand. I've never understood that.
No. But the thing is, with a celebrity, it's kind of acknowledged that it's the celebrity's fans who are most upset. When a royal dies in this country, they don't acknowledge that only the royalists, the fans of the royals, are upset. And only the hardcore fans. But then they show those pictures and make out that we're all like that. No, we're not. We're just not. Princess Diana's death was a tragedy. It was a terrible thing. But it didn't stop the nation. And so maybe we should look at the things we have in common with North Korea. A small nuclear arsenal, an unelected head of state, and a dodgy media that doesn't print the truth for fear of upsetting the unelected head of state. We've got so much in common. I mean, they don't think their leader defecates. Well, I've never spoken to the toilet. I've seen no interview with the toilet cleaner after a Queen's visit. She used the loo when she was on the visit. You had to clean it. How bad was it? Did she pebble dash it? You know, was the skid mark? I mean, how was it?
Yeah.
No, you don't talk about the Queen going to the toilet. You don't do that. Well, isn't that pretty close to our leader does not?
It was quite weird. It was an upper decker. Why did she do that? I just don't understand.
It was just
strange.
Was the tea too cold that we gave her? You know, But that's exactly how it's done in North Korea. Ours is you don't talk about them defecating. Theirs is they don't defecate. It's just a slightly more hardcore version of what we have here. I'm sure he thinks the world smells of fresh paint, and our queen thinks the world smells of fresh paint. Because everything is freshly painted before they arrive. Our queen shakes hands with her subjects wearing gloves that go up to her elbows. She doesn't want to be touched by the peasants.
By the plebs? Yeah. Yes.
She never takes her gloves off when she's accepting bouquets of flowers from three-year-olds.
Speaking of defecating, I remember being going to a golf match at Aronimink, and it was 2012 or 13, and Tiger Woods was playing, and we got there just as he was finishing up teeing off on the 15th or 16th hole. And there were thousands and thousands of people around, and he teed off and then went to the loo.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout the crowd, he's going to the bathroom. I'm sorry. Why does he need that level of scrutiny? Why is that news? Yes, I'm sure he is. That's fine. Everyone does. Yeah. You will in about an hour's time.
Yeah.
Because you've had 17 beers. He's going to the bathroom. It spread like wildfire.
Wow.
Throughout the crowd. What? This is not news.
People are idiots. And all we do is continually get proof of that. Yeah.
I think it's the more of us in a group we get, the stupider we are.
Yes. It there is basically a level of intelligence. And every extra person you add to that group, the intelligence is divided between them. So they have that fraction of intelligence. So one person on their own is pretty smart. You put them with someone else when there's two people and they're influencing each other. They're more likely to do dumb things together than alone. Because it's and say dumb things to each other than they would if they were alone. And then you put a third person in, well, they want to impress those other two. They're gonna say something dumb or do something dumb. You know. Like I've never heard of a racist rally where only one person shows up. It's always a lot of people.
Yes, yes.
And that's part of that. That's what's going on there. Because the IQ gets diluted the extra, more people you get.
Yes, there's never a KKK march that's just one guy.
No. Just going like, you know what? These Jews and these blacks, this is terrible. He's never like that. No, I'm sick of them.
Yeah. I don't care for them.
Yeah.
And I'm going to march.
Yeah. You know, you never hear of a solo lynch mob. Or a lynching. It's always a mob. It's always a mob. It's not only a group. It's an uncontrolled group. It's an undisciplined group.
It's a mob mentality. It's not a guy mentality.
Yeah. Which makes you wonder about the rationale behind democracy. Because where does democracy end and lynch mob begin? Just because more people think this is a good idea doesn't make it a good idea. Because whenever...
Well, just look at the last US election.
Exactly.
Donald Trump was elected.
Yeah.
Because more people thought he was the right choice doesn't make it the right choice.
Yeah. But if you look at progress, progress does not happen group first. It happens individual first. Everybody used to think the world was flat. Then suddenly, most people didn't think that the world was round. One person went, hey, you know what? I've been looking at these stars and stuff. I think we might be living on a ball.
Yeah.
If that was democratically decided, do we live on a ball or a plate? There's no way Ball would win. He's on his own. Till he convinces somebody else. And then he convinces somebody else. But I bet even within the first few years, he was way off a majority. Way off. It took a lot of time to convince that other side that he was right. But just because he was in the minority for all those years, that doesn't mean he was wrong. This is why democracy only works for really old ideas. For brand new ideas, you really have to go with the minority, because there's absolutely no way that the majority are going to get there for a few hundred years, whatever the new idea is.
It's true. Yeah, that's a good point.
Democracy holds back progress. It holds it back because people hold on to the old idea that they're comfortable. This disruptive thinking.
They like the status quo.
Yeah, they don't. It's like, what? What? What are you telling me? That can't be right. No way. No way can the world be a ball. Look, it's a flat surface. It looks flat. No, I'm staying with flat. I'm staying with flat.
No. Look to your left. Look to your right.
Yeah.
Do you see ball shape? No.
Yeah.
It's flat.
And you know what?
I asked
everybody at work, and I couldn't find a single person that thought we lived on a ball. So you must be wrong, mate. That's... So... This democracy thing, it needs a, it's a, in principle, it's a good idea, but it's got so many holes in it. Basically, all you've got to do is whip up a lynch mob type mentality and you can do anything. Hitler was elected.
Yeah.
Hitler was elected. That's bizarre. But he was elected. By the majority. Because the majority, the thing is, they don't know they're being fooled until much later on. Germany is really embarrassed that they got suckered into that. Really embarrassed. No statues of him. But this majority, some people, I can't remember.
But they elected him, and they loved him for quite some time.
Yeah. Yeah, they did.
There was no, yes, let's get this guy in. Whoops. Ooh, well, we backed the wrong horse.
Yeah.
Let's get him out. Let's get someone else in.
But once again, the people who were against him would have been in the minority. And it took them a long time, you know, the revelation about death camps, things like that. Then everybody started coming round. But originally, the people who said, this Hitler thing isn't working out, this is terrible, this is bad for Germany, bad for the world, they were in a minority. But they were right.
Yeah.
This majority always being right, where did that come from? They're more likely to be wrong.
It came from the majority.
Yeah, so by definition, it was wrong. Remember, I worked at BBC Wiltshire, and we were going to do a thing. The town used to have a railway works, and there was a hooter, a steam-powered hooter that used to wake the town up, and everybody who heard the town all went to the railway works to go and work, because not everybody had a watch when it started. Anyway, the railway works is long gone, and the hooter's long gone, but some of the pipe work was there, and one of the things I wanted to do on the breakfast show was bring back the sound of the hooter, and I looked at all ways of doing it, because the actual pipes and the whistle part of it were still intact on top of the old building. I even looked at getting like maybe a traction engine together to blow the steam up it, because it was steam thing. But traction engines don't even have close to the pressure that you need. You need very high pressure steam to make it work. Anyway, I discovered there was an old recording in reasonably good quality from one of the last times the hooter blew. So I found a guy who hired out sound equipment, and we built these stacks of speakers, like enough for like an Elton John concert or something, outside where this hooter was. And we were going to play the sound of the hooter through the speakers and wake the town up that morning at whenever it was, 8 o'clock or whenever they used to do it. And so we were organizing this show of when we were going to do Blow the Hooter, bring the hooter back to the town after, I think it had been gone like 50 years or something. It was an anniversary of it being gone.
Wow.
And we're going to do it live on the radio, and we're going to do all these things. So my idea was I would be in the studio, and we will now cross live to our reporter who's at the hooter. Well, then, of course, it's being the BBC, a load of meetings went on without me there. And it was decided at the meetings that I would be there on the location where the hooter is. And I went, no, no, it'll be far better if I run the show as normal and tease it up and say, in half an hour, we're going to be crossing to the hooter, do all the other things, and then take phone calls from people around the town that heard it and see if it was just like it was in their day when they remember the real one and do all that, you know, as an anchor. It'll work better for me being in the studio. And they said, well, you know what? We all decided at the meeting that you're going to be at the thing, so you're outvoted, mate. And I went, now, hang on. That doesn't mean it's the best idea, especially considering I wasn't even at the meeting. People's mentality is that if they've got the numbers, they can steamroller anything through. As it was, I refused to go down. So that kind of stumped them. I'm like, well, I'm not going down. So I'm going to be here. Do you want me to do the radio show, or do you want me to sit in the lunchroom? Because I'm not going there. You can do what you like. And in the end, we did the show that way with me as the anchor from the studio. And I took some great calls, and it was a great show. But the thing is, my point is that people just because this, you know, democracy rule.
You were outvoted.
But I
wasn't even there.
Yeah, but they just think that this actually means something just because more people. If I'd been in the meeting, I'm sure I could have convinced them. If we'd had a vote after that, maybe. But they hadn't even thought about that or taking phone calls from listeners or any of that. They just thought, oh, well, he'll just be down there. It's all been his idea. He's pushed this thing through. They really just didn't understand how the thing was going to work on the radio. They just didn't understand. But my point is, they thought because they had the numbers, well, it's going to go this way.
We have the numbers, and you're outvoted.
I'm outvoted. I wasn't even in the election. I didn't even campaign.
Yeah. I didn't even know there was a vote, for that matter.
Or a meeting.
Yes.
Yeah. That was someplace. But yeah, I don't know why we are so obsessed with this democracy thing. Mind you, Kim Jong Unhinged, he wasn't voted in either, was he? So, yeah. Mind you, our head of state wasn't. Hey, that's the thing. They think that democracy is really important, but our head of state is not elected. And our upper house, the House of Lords, they're unelected as well. The only people that are elected in this so-called democracy are the House of Commons. And they're the third tier. You've got the monarch at the top, followed by the House of Lords, followed by the lower house. They're third. They're not even second.
The only reason the Windsors are in power is because they took it forcefully from someone else.
That's how royals get to be the royal ruling family.
That's how
royals
get to be royals.
Yeah. And they're not even Windsors. That's a made-up name. They're Saxe-Coburgs. They're German. They invented the name Windsor. They made it up. The whole thing is based on a lie anyway. It's fake. It's all fake. But people continue to fall for it and happily pay their tax so these people can live in obscene luxury and opulence and be educated in private schools that their children can't afford to go to because they pay so much tax. Yeah. It just makes no sense. Let's get to this week's guest. Tony Prince is a British broadcasting legend. He went from spinning discs in clubs in the north of England to broadcasting on the pirate ship Radio Caroline, and eventually was heard right across Europe on Radio Luxembourg. He invited me into his Berkshire home, where we sat, drank coffee, and talked about his amazing life and career.
I'm ready to rock. Tony, it's 40 years since we lost Elvis. I want to talk about him a little bit later on, but first I need to clear something up. In the late 80s, I bought a VHS tape of a concert movie, Elvis, That's the Way It Is.
Yeah.
There is footage there in the middle of it of an Elvis Appreciation Society convention in Luxembourg.
Yeah.
From, I think, 1970. There's a DJ in a Superman t-shirt hosting an event on stage. Is that you?
Yeah, you also see me in that film going to the airport to get his tandem that he'd sent over to auction off. That's right. Me as well.
Right.
And we're driving through on this tandem, two of us, guy from RCA Records and myself, and we pedal it all the way to the new theatre where the convention was taking place.
That's right. That's
onto
right.
the stage. And then you see me standing on my head sometime, which I always used to do, you know, rock and roll and get a bit silly. And then we raffled it off, you know, some guy won this incredible tandem with Elvis's name on it. Wouldn't you love to own that today? Nobody knows where it is now.
We're caught in a trap. I can't walk out. Because I love you too much, baby. Why can't you see what you're doing to me? When you don't believe a word I'm saying, we can't go on together with suspicious minds. Suspicious mind. So if an old friend I know, shove it up your nose just by to say hello, would I still see suspicion in your eyes? Here we go again. Whoa, asking where I've been. You can't see the tears I real I'm crying. We can't go on together with suspicious minds. And we can't build our dreams on suspicious minds. Won't let our love survive, oh no.
So how did you come to be a part of that?
God, I mean, you've got to go back to the pirate radio period of my career. People in America never experienced the 60s pirates. We had very, very poor radio in the UK. We had Radio Luxembourg at night broadcasting from Luxembourg on the AM frequency, medium wave, we used to call it. And you had in the day the BBC Lights program. And it was so light, they hardly played any pop music. I mean, here we are in a country where you've got the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the Kinks, Searchers, all these great bands coming out, and the BBC are playing half an hour of records a day. And the reason for that is the Musicians' Union wouldn't let the BBC play that many records because they said they're putting musicians out of work. So it was basically the Musicians' Union that caused pirate radio to begin in the United Kingdom. One day, a guy was managing Georgie Fame, a blues singer, couldn't get his record played, so he went to his dad's shipyard in Greenore in Southern Ireland, and he brought a ferry in from Holland, and he built the mast to 180 feet in the clouds. And the locals were going by watching this mast get bigger and bigger, and one guy went by one day and said, Jesus, they're going to need a lot of sailcloth on that one.
Gotta go, I hope you're ready, cause take a look outside.
Anyway, they finally took it out to the south of England, off 3 miles outside international waters, so they weren't doing anything illegal because they weren't within the vicinity of the United Kingdom. They were in international waters, and that's when pop music really began in the UK. That was Radio Caroline.
serving the British Isles. 14 swinging hours a day. This is 199 Radio Caroline.
I spent 2 years on that ship. There were many other ships by the end of the 1967 when they were made illegal. So that's when the Elvis Presley Fan Club of Great Britain recognised I was playing more Elvis than anyone else, because I was a devout Elvis fan. And I loved his music, always did. From he woke me up. As John Lennon said, before Elvis, there was nothing. He was absolutely right, you know. So anyway, I started going to conventions with all the fans. And they loved meeting me because I was a big fan on the radio, on the pirate ship. And then one day, Todd Slaughter, who ran the fan club, he still does to this very day, he said, "Tony, I'm taking 200 fans to see Elvis play in Vegas. Do you want to come with us?" Do I want to go with them? You know, get your skates on. Yeah, we went over to Tupelo to see where he was born. We had a civic reception. The mayor and the Ladies Guild of Tupelo welcomed us. We went to Memphis, and of course we went to Graceland. Uncle Vester, you know, his uncle who looked after the grounds, was wonderful. And I've got a microphone with me. I'm interviewing everybody I see, you know. And it was great. We went to Nashville. And then finally we went over to Las Vegas, and he was playing the Hilton. And Todd and I didn't know how Colonel would welcome us. But we were in for a big surprise. He was really, really friendly. We spent an afternoon in his suite, which covered all one level of the Hilton Hotel, about the second floor up, whereas Elvis had the top floors. And we just got on famously, you know. He was telling us all these funny stories about his early days in the business. So he said, "Listen, guys," he said, "you can't all go and see Elvis, but Todd, Tony, if you'll choose half a dozen kids to take with you tonight." Now he's told us we're going to meeting Elvis. The thrill of
so
that.
So you didn't even know at that stage?
Not at all, no. But now I do. We're going to see Elvis tonight in his dressing room before his show. And we've got to select some fans to go with us. So I pushed my luck. I said, "Colonel, I've been writing to you for years, you know, about doing an interview with Elvis, because he's never been over to the United Kingdom. He's never played Europe. So, you know, I'd like to just have a few words with him." He said, "Tony Prince," he said, "you know Elvis doesn't do one-to-one interviews. He does press receptions." So I'm forlorn. I'm looking dejected. "Okay, Colonel." He said, "but I suppose if you sneak your microphone into the dressing room and I don't see it, you'll be okay." So he kind of gave me a wink that that would be okay. So that's what I did. If you look at the photographs, and one of them is on the wall in Graceland, you'll see me standing with a red bag over my shoulder, and there's a microphone sticking out of it. That's where the Nagra tape recorder is, and that's where I got my messages from Elvis.
Elvis, very quickly, we've got 50 million listeners listening to an eight-hour spectacle in Europe to your show tonight. Have you any message for all the fans in Great Britain and Europe listening to your show tonight?
I just tell them that I really love their devotion, and that we've got to come see them. We've got to. I've been saying it for years, but we will.
We pray you will, Elvis. Thank you. A badge for your
collection. I did that twice. I went on stage at the Hilton that year, the first year. The Colonel, I really pushed my luck. You know, I said, "Now, can I go on stage and interview?" He kicked me out of the office. But after we'd met Elvis, we went back up into the showroom. And suddenly, just before Elvis started, the Colonel came over to me. He said, "Well, Mr. Prince, you want to introduce Elvis? You better come with me." Well, I hadn't rehearsed anything. I just pushed my luck, and my luck was just streaming along. So I followed him to the edge of the stage. He said, "This is Mr. Prince. Take him to the center of tabs. He's going to introduce the show." Wow. I'm walking now across the stage where all the musicians, the singers, they're all there, you know. I haven't seen Elvis perform yet. I'm going to see in a minute. But before he performs, I'm going to have to go on stage and introduce him. So they pull the tabs back, and everybody applauds me. They don't know who the hell I am, you know. But they all applaud me. The wonderful.
But you're
friend.
On stage in Vegas, so you must be.
I know. I must be somebody. I think they thought I was a comedian or something, or you know, a dwarf juggler or something. Anyway, I hit the microphone. They'd all applauded me. It was just wonderful, you know. They were just so polite. The Americans, you know what they're like. They're just a warm, warm race. And they welcomed me, not knowing who the hell I was. And I said, ladies and gentlemen, my name's Tony Prince. I'm a DJ from Radio Luxembourg in Europe. Well, half of them must have been in the army in Germany because they all like stood up and clapped because Luxembourg was so important to them while they were in Europe, you know, not just to the Brits. So that was nice. And I said, who's come more than 2,000 miles to be here? Who's come more than 5,000? So it went on. I said, these people with their hands up, there's just 200 people with their hands up now. I said, these are the Elvis Presley fan club of Great Britain. And they got a massive round of applause, you know. So they suddenly felt like stars. I said, you know what it's like? Elvis has never performed in Europe. And we have a saying, don't we? If Mohammed won't come to the mountain, those 200 hands in the air represent a British mountain of love and adoration for the king. And ladies and gentlemen, the biggest thrill of my life is to be here tonight and introduce Elvis Presley, and that was it. Then I was out, going back.
You'd prepped nothing ahead of time.
I prepped nothing. I'd lived the whole damn thing. And I'm walking off stage now, and they've started playing Also Zarathustra. And as I'm walking off stage, over in the right-hand side is Elvis, and he's looking at me, and he's clapping his hands gently at me, you know. Ah, wow. I mean, I can still tear up thinking about that, you know. So then I went back into the showroom and all the fans were like wide-eyed looking at me. What a lucky DJ you were. And then we watched the show. Saw about three or four shows that week. It was magnificent. Now, at the end of the 4 days, we had one last meeting with the colonel. He'd said, look, you can't all go and see Elvis, but what I want you to do is bring them all to my office. They'll meet Tom Diskin, my assistant, and all my secretary, and all the team here who make Elvis's life work. So bring them in crowds of, let's say, 10 at a time, and we'll take them 20 of them, you know, 20 tens, and we'll sell them some product cheaper here than they can get it in the lobby. Mr. Diskin, how much does the huge hound dog cost? They've got these 5-foot hound dogs, right? Oh, those are $35. He says, right, let's knock that down to 15 for these lot, okay? And then he starts, you know, rhyming off all the different merchandise that he sells
downstairs.
Because
he's an old carny, he knows how to do this.
He is, you're absolutely right. He's an old carny hustler. And so he's hustling our fans now for some bucks. But he's knocking lots of money up, and it sounds great, you know. So they all come in, they're all told, right, look, this package is going to cost you $30. It would normally cost you $100, so it's a great deal. So they all came, and nearly all of them got the $30 out and walked out with these incredible packages. You've never seen so many hound dogs walking down the street in Las Vegas, you know.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog crying all the time. You ain't nothing but a hound dog crying all the time.
It was amazing. And at the end, this is the kick now. Everybody says, what was Colonel Parker like? He was a really enigmatic kind of guy. Nobody really knew what made him tick. Was he good for Elvis? Was he bad for Elvis? What kind of a guy was he? And I tell this story that, you know, after they'd all gone, left the suite, how much have we got there, Mr. Slaughter? He says to Todd. Todd's now counting up all the books, you know. And it's something like $5,690, something like that. Good, he said, come here. he gets his wallet out and he puts the equivalent of $300 or $400 on top of it. He says, now you got a nice round $6,000. He says, when you guys go to Los Angeles tomorrow, I want you to hire a hall, hire a group, somebody who sounds a bit like Elvis would be good, and throw a party on Elvis. That's what I want you to do with that money. And that is Colonel Parker for you. He's a hustler, but a big-hearted hustler.
Well, let's go back to the beginning then. So actually, that probably makes you the only British DJ to appear in an Elvis movie.
Were there any other DJs? I don't know. It's quite a claim to fame, isn't it? You know, yeah. Interviewing him, the only DJ, I did it twice. I went back the following year, did it again, took my wife the next year. Big thrill for her. Go on stage, introduce him. And listen, to end it all, the night he died, I happened to be in Luxembourg on the air. I'm program director by now, but I did a week in Luxembourg and 2 weeks in London. A week live, 2 weeks recorded. That was quite something. I had a four-hour show. I walked into the studio, 11 o'clock at night in the UK, and my colleague Mark Wesley came at me in the corridor. Tony, have you heard the news? I said, what news? He said, Elvis is dead. I thought it was a sick joke. You know, I said, pull the other one. What's the joke? He said, no, look here. And we had a news provided by the Daily Mirror newspaper in England on a telex back in those days. And there it was. And I read it that Elvis was dead. So I've got 10 minutes. I run downstairs. I get all my records, that are Elvis records. I've got them all in one cupboard down there. And I carry them upstairs. I've now got a couple of minutes left. I phone London. I phone my boss, Alan Keane. I said, Alan, have you heard that? He said, yes, Tony, I've heard the news. I'm so glad you are the one out there doing this. I said, you might not be in a minute because I'm telling you, I am not playing any commercials tonight. I'm not playing any happy jingles. He said, I fully understand. You've got my permission. He said, it's just as well, isn't it? Because you'd still do it even if I didn't give you permission. I said, damn right. So I hit the airwaves, you know, and we've got an on-air recording. I didn't have the common sense to record that studio quality, but somebody recorded it all off-air on that awful medium wave. So we have it, you know, it's around, you know, we've done a CD release of it. It's been on many websites. I've used it in many radio programs. But it was the biggest challenge of my life to hold myself together for 4 hours, as I talked to the fans around the world, as I talked to Todd Slaughter, who had a problem. He's got to do a convention this Saturday. Should he cancel it? What do I do, Tony? I said, well, let's ask the fans. Right. So they start phoning in and they all say, you've got to carry on with the convention, you know. So it's a very dramatic and emotional show. And when it ended, 4 hours later, I went out into Luxembourg. The station's off the air now. It only broadcast at night. I walked down to my hotel and there's a bar just closing down. He's putting the tables up and the chairs on the tables. And I walk in and I knew the guy and I said, listen, I've got to have a large scotch. He said, what? He said, I'm closed. I said, come on, give me a large scotch. Elvis Presley's dead. What? So I had two large scotches with this guy. And then I walked to the hotel. It's 5 a.m. in England now, and I phoned my wife, who lived in England, right? I'm doing my week in a hotel in Luxembourg. And she woke up, she'd gone to sleep, and she listened while I cried for 25 minutes. I couldn't stop crying. Every time I controlled
myself. Well, you'd been holding it in for hours.
Exactly, exactly. And that's how it affected me. You know, I was a real, true Elvis Presley fan.
Get closer, the lights are going dim. The sound of your breathing has made the mood I'm in. All of my resistance lying on the floor, taking me to places I've never been before. Ooh, and I can feel it. Way down, way down, way down, way down, way down.
as a kid, you grew up in Oldham, Lancashire, with a picture of Elvis on your wall, and you later found out that Elvis had a picture of you on the wall.
That's right. I mean, the meetings with Elvis were photographed by Colonel Parker's photographer, and we got copies of them sent to us, which was lovely. But one Christmas, my wife has bought me this wonderful, large, full-colour book of every room in Graceland. It's a coffee table book, a real high-quality one, you know. So after Christmas lunch, I'm sitting on my own looking through from page to page, and I suddenly get to the trophy room, and there is the trophy we gave him in 72. And right next to the trophy, on the wall, is a photo of me and Elvis and Todd.
I mean, incredible.
Christine, kids, come here, everybody, look at this. I'm crying again, you know, with the emotion of it being on his wall in Graceland. I mean, how crazy is that? He was on my wall, now I'm on his wall. Oh, it's such a tragedy that he died, you know.
So tell us about, for those who don't know Oldham, it was probably a lot more provincial when you grew up.
It used to be a mill town, you know, they used to make a lot of cotton up there. It was a right mucky place, you know, it was a very working class place. And it was a place that inspired young men to escape. Right. And I knew, I'd gone to art school at the age of 13. I'd passed an exam. How I did, I don't know. But I went to Oldham Art School from 13 to 15 and came almost bottom of the class 2 years in a row. And I knew I wasn't going to be an artist. And I thought, what do I do?
So what did your parents do? What kind of family?
My dad was a scrap metal merchant. You know, he had a yard. He had his own yard and he got scrap metal. My mother was just a good old worker, you know. She worked in, she used to make army tents. Originally, before I was born, she was a bus conductress. My dad was a bus driver. I think that's where they met.
So just honest to goodness, salt of the earth.
They were, yeah. And the family, thank God, the family, his brothers and my aunties had farms just outside Oldham. So as a young kid, a very young kid, I had a lot of life on the farm. You know, that's where I first fell in love with riding horses. We had a cart horse called Brandy, and I used to ride it over the hills of Grains Bar in the higher reaches of Oldham. And that kind of gave me the bug for horse riding. And when I was leaving school, a girl in my class said, "You want to be a jockey?" I was the right size, you know, I'm a little fella. And I said, "Give me some addresses." So she gave me three addresses, and I wrote to them all. And I said, "I'd love to be a jockey." And the first one came back, and I got a 3 month trial at the Gerald Armstrong stable in Yorkshire. So that was my first job, and I shared a bedroom with a guy who stuck it out. I didn't. He was called Willie Carson. People of America may not know him, but he became the Queen's jockey. He won the Derby a number of times, and he's still a mate of mine to this day. But we were apprentices together. I left after about 8 months, came back to Oldham. Then the big thing happened. You know that left turn in your life? You could have turned right, you turn left. I went to Butlin's holiday camp.
On holiday?
Yeah.
Right.
Which was the place to go in those days for young kids.
And these were like, they were very, very good value holidays for working class families. Everything was included.
Yeah, you had a chalet. Your rows and rows of chalets. It looked like a prison camp, really, you know.
But there was a fun fair and there was a show every night.
There was a huge swimming pool and, listen, the Rock and Jive Ballroom. And that's where I headed every single night. And that's where I heard Elvis and Ray Charles, What Did I Say? And Bobby Darin, Dream Lover, and all those great Paul Anka, Diana, all those great early rock and roll records. They just took over. They just came into my ears and directed me in life. I couldn't resist rock and roll music. And one afternoon, I went into this bar. I went about 5 years in a row to this holiday camp. And then came the left turn. One afternoon, I wandered in the afternoon because the jukebox was playing and they had a milk bar. And there was this guy sitting at a table on his own. And I got a milkshake and I went and sat down next to him. "Hello, fella." He said, "Are you all right?" He's polishing his cowboy boots. And I said, "I love the band." He was the drummer with the group who played every night. Rory Storm and the Hurricanes. And of course, I'm sat next to Ringo Starr, who hadn't yet joined the Beatles. Because I said how much I loved rock and roll. I said, "I know all the songs." I stand in front of my mum and dad's bedroom mirror with a cricket bat and pretend I'm Elvis. He said, "Why don't you stop pretending and get up and sing in the talent competition on Thursday night?"
Ringo said this to you?
Yeah. I said, "I might do." He said, "Well, what would you like to sing with us? I'll tell you whether we can play it." I said, "Well, I'll do something like you know, Gene Vincent song. He said, we can do that. He said, so I'll tell them, I'll put you on the list. So I'd never drunk in my life before. I'm about 15 years of age, and my mates persuade me to go into this bar and have a quick couple of whiskies. So I'm pretty splattered by the time I go in the Rock and Jive Ballroom, you know, and I'd said to Ringo, I'll do this if you'll lend me a pair of your cowboy boots. I wanted to look cool, you know. He said, I'll get you a pair.
So you're wearing Ringo's boots?
Well, as I got to the side of stage, he points to these boots. He's got me a pair, but of course, you know, he's a lot bigger than me and his boots are far too big, but I put them on anyway. And then somebody got up and sang, a woman got up and sang, you know, I'm in this line. And then Rory Storm came over to me and he leant down and he says, well, I was called Tommy then. I wasn't Tony Prince yet. I hadn't got a stage name. Well, Tommy, what are you going to sing? I said, Bebopalulu. He said, what key? I said, I'm in row E14, Shelley number 9. He said, not what key for your Shelley. What key are you singing in? That's how naive I was, right? I said, I don't know. You choose it. He said, all right, we'll do it in C. So I gets up there and I belts out Bebopalulu. And Gene Vincent used to get to the middle eight and he'd kick his leg over the microphone and then he'd catch the microphone stand at his back and he'd sway moodily with the mic stand. And I thought, I'll do that. So I get the microphone down at a 45 degree. Go, Johnny. Johnny Guitar was the guitarist. Go, Johnny. And I kicks my leg up over the mic stand and the boot comes flying off into the air, the cowboy boot. Lands on a teddy boy's head. I fall off the stage with the microphone booming everywhere and I fall on the floor of the dance floor 6 foot down. Well, everybody's just full of laughter. It's just an amazing experience. I mean, I've made a prat of myself, but what an injection of audience I had. They loved me for what I'd just done, you know.
Yeah.
I was helped back on stage and that was it. Rory said, give a big round of applause. I got this massive round of applause. So the drug was taken.
Did you win?
I came second.
Did you? That's not bad.
I got a boot polish kit.
That is that what you want?
Yeah. I should have kept it, really.
So the trap was set. You got that buzz from the crowd.
It was even worse than that. The trap was like wide open because just after the event, these three guys came up to me and said, Tommy, we're from Oldham. We're forming a group. We've been rehearsing now for months. And we need a good vocalist. I said, what are you looking at me for then? And that was it. After the holiday, I joined the Jasons. And maybe a year and a half touring Manchester clubs, covering all the songs. And it was just before the Beatles broke. Now, the group wouldn't turn professional. The drummer was a plumber. The rhythm guitarist was a fireman. And the lead guitarist, Alan, was an accountant.
So all good jobs, really,
well,
for Northern Lads.
Absolutely,
you know?
And that was the problem, you see. They loved doing the group part-time, but when we got offered a Butlin season, which I wanted to take, I had nothing to lose.
You were offered a season then, yeah?
Yeah, we were, and they wouldn't take it, and I was mortified. I mean, I was working as an apprentice toolmaker now, trying to get a career going, you know. I'd been doing it for about 6 months. So I'm going to work with the green overalls and oil all over me and on the bus, trying to hide my face in case any of the fans who go to the Savoy on Thursday see me. And here we are with an opportunity to become professional and they won't take it. So I left the band. I was just mortified and I went solo for a while. And then what happened was a new ballroom, as we used to call clubs in those days, opened called the Top Rank Astoria. A fabulous venue. And I'd got a date with a girl and I took her there and we stood at the bar. And the band leader, he's got a 15-piece orchestra here, right? And when they have a break, there's a guy with glasses on sitting behind a table playing records. He looks very uncool, but he's supposed to be a DJ. And he's playing Little Eva Locomotion and all that kind of stuff. Chubby Checker, Let's Twist Again. And I'm enjoying the atmosphere.
Just to keep the energy up in between the lines.
Yeah, well, no, what it was, you see, the big band used to have a break and a trio used to play the music, but records have arrived now and the punters want the records.
Yeah.
They love the original artists.
Yeah.
Why should they have a cover version by a trio? But anyway, Johnny Francis, the band leader, come and stands next to me because he knew me from the Savoy. He used to be in a band there as well. I said, what are you doing, Tommy? I said, I'm Tony now. I've changed my name. I'm Tony Prince now, you know. He said, you're still with the Jasons? I said, no, I'm not. I've gone solo. They wouldn't turn professional. He said, you won't believe this. I'm offering you a job to sing with my band. I said, I've just taken it. We shook hands. I said, when do I start? He said, do you want to know how much you're going to get paid? I said, I don't give a damn. I just want to sing with your band, you know.
So then you're a professional entertainer.
I'm a professional singer guitarist.
Well, how are your parents with that? Because, you know, a lot of parents up north, I mean, as an apprentice, they're going to be, you know, get a trade, job for life, all that. But showbiz is a bit different.
I know what you're saying, but they were so proud of what I'd done. They were proud of me when I went off to become an apprentice jockey. They were proud of me when I started singing with the Jasons, going to clubs, they'd come and see us. They were proud as punch of their little lad. I was an only child, and they just wanted me to be happy. And they knew music was very important to me. And when the Johnny Francis offer came through, I mean, you've got to bear in mind, as an apprentice toolmaker, I was getting £2.50 a week, which then was about $4, $5 a week. Johnny Francis is paying me £16.50.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot of money for a little kid like me.
And big crowds in those top-ranked clubs as well.
Completely packed. I mean, Saturday night was packed. It was 1,200 capacity, and it was full every Saturday. And then Top Rank moved us to Bristol to another new venue. They moved the band, and they moved me as the DJ. And the Musicians' Union came. This is a really big venue now. It holds 1,800 people. And we used to fill it on Saturday, Sunday, and Tuesday was only records. There was no band on Tuesday, just me playing records. Packed. The Top Rank were just making absolute fortune. Then the Musicians Union secretary came to see us all to make sure we're getting the right terms. And he looked at me and he said, you're getting union rate like the rest of the band, but you're playing records when they go to the bar for a drink. You're working all night. You're working Tuesday night. You should get more than this. I thought, hello, I can get my first car now the way this is going, you know. So I said, thank you. So off he went to try and get me more money, my Musicians Union secretary. 2 weeks later, I've still got the letter with a red stamp on it, Keep Music Live. Letter from the Musicians Union secretary. It's been brought to my attention that you're breaking union rules. Keep Music Live. We do not encourage records to be played in ballrooms because they're putting musicians out of work, and we have to ask you as a member of the union to stop playing them, or you may have to be expelled from the union. So Top Rank got the gist of the case. They all came down to the union meeting, the head office. I was a test case. They told me silently that if the MU decide to throw me out, they offered me, I think it was like three times more than I was getting as union rate. I'd negotiated, I'd become a little hustler by then. They offered me double and they said, come on, give me treble, I'm changing my career here. I'm not going to be Elvis anymore, you've got to compensate for that, you know.
Yeah.
So they'd offered me a great wage if I only be the DJ, if the union throw me out. As indeed they did. There was 100 people came to the union meeting. They were all members of bands in Bristol, and 10 of them voted to keep me in the union. They were members of my own band. Everybody else voted me out. So that
you
was it.
You were voted out of the Musicians Union.
I was expelled from the Musicians Union and told they were sympathetic to the situation I was in, and if I ever wanted to rejoin, I could pay a £50 fine and get back in. I never rejoined.
That's part one of my chat with Tony Prince. In part two, we talk about what life was like on board a pirate radio ship and the celebrities that he's met and worked with over the years, including Paul McCartney, Keith Moon, and Jimi Hendrix, and the influence that Radio Luxembourg had on the other side of what we used to call the Iron Curtain. Part two of my chat with Tony Prince, the Royal Ruler, coming up in a couple of weeks' time, right here on London Calling. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Graham Mac. If you want to hear more Mac Nuggets, check out my website, macmedia.co.uk, and subscribe to my Bob FM show on Apple Podcasts. Got a question or something to say? Send me an email. Put your phone number in the email. I might call you back on the show. Might Skype you. My email address is graham@macmedia.co.uk. And you spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next time. Ta-da.